Welcome back, Badgers. Another first. We like doing first. We've got two brothers in the house today, with Scott Roberts and Graham Roberts.
How you doing?
Sons of Gareth Roberts. And there's a niece as well, isn't there, around now?
There is, yeah. So we got Lucy Buckley, so niece on mum's side.
Yeah.
So she's dad's apprentice.
So the family, the greenkeeping family, is growing. It could be argued that you're the... probably the most prolific greenkeeping.
It's the easiest way to get staff is just get someone else from the family, I think.
Yes. Yeah. So to have a dad and two sons, I mean, we talked this to Gareth, and luckily enough to have a meal with Gareth last night, which was great, and absolutely love him to bits. And you can see how proud he is to have two boys that are now both now course managers, yeah. Which is, yeah. And Gareth himself at Huntley.
Yeah.
And hopefully your niece soon, in the next couple of decades or whatever it could be as well, you never know.
Yep.
Yeah, I think she's loving it. She's really enjoying it and that, and I think, yeah, she's getting stuck in with it. It's a small club where they're at, and so she gets really involved with it, and of course dad's passed with it all. He's really keen on getting, like, she came down here for BTME and just getting her as exposed as much as possible to all the things that are great about greenkeeping.
And before we kind of get into it, what you discuss... your childhood growing up together on a golf course, but let's start with kind of your earliest memories, Scott, of growing up
trying
on
to
the
go
golf
back.
Course.
So I mean, it's just, yeah. So I was born in London, but we moved straight across to Hankley Common when I was very very young. So yeah, born London, moved straight across to Hankley, and all my childhood memories are just being on the golf course. So I just thought it was standard to live in a house with a 300-acre garden of a golf course, really. We used to go out and help out quite a lot when we were very young, sit in the tractor while it was out vertidraining greens and stuff like that.
There's a great picture of you in a John Deere tractor, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which will... If you send me, we'll put it in the footnotes for this.
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah,
fantastic.
It's the old 2650. So yeah. We keep talking about the idea of trying to recreate that.
But yes.
I don't think we have a tractor big enough yet for the three of us.
We're going to need a bigger tractor.
Yeah. We should have had you at the Llama Show the other week, and we could have got you in a big 400 horsepower.
There we go. That would have worked. Well, you could have done to yours and jump in your new
getting the 51.
There
we
go. That'll work. We'll squeeze in there.
Yeah.
That's a phenomenal photo.
Yeah. And then getting a bit older and helping out on the weekends when I was in my early teens and that. I'll be honest, and I say this quite a lot, I hated greenkeeping then.
Oh, did you?
Divoting tees, raking bunkers, I couldn't stand it. I wanted to play golf. I played golf every single day, and I was like, I'm not doing this. This isn't for me.
And did you find... See, I kind of worry about my kids being living on site and golf being too accessible for them, that they actually probably maybe won't get into it as much. How did you find that?
Well, I think your love just naturally comes from it, really, because I think... The one that really hit me was when I was in college doing a BTEC in golf studies. And again, still no interest in greenkeeping, but I had to do some work experience. So my dad said, oh, I can put you in touch with Cammy McMillan at Queenwood and go over there. I was like, okay then. So I went over to see Queenwood, which is just on a different planet.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. I went there for 1 week work experience, and I left 3.5 years later. And that was
Jeez.
Me. Absolutely.
So that was the first place you worked then?
That was my first full-time greenkeeping job. Yeah. So once I saw the sheer potential, you know, massive team of guys, just unbelievable standards, all the kit, and I was like, oh, I
what a place to start
this.
your greenkeeping career.
It was, but then so I did 3 years at Queenwood, and then it was quite a long drive. It was long hours. It was incredible to work there, but a job came up at Hankley. My dad kind of was really hinting at it. You should come and work at Hankley with us. Mm-hmm. And that was with my, you were first assistant, weren't you? And,
oh, no. How do you do what your brother tells you to do?
He doesn't.
Discipline him, Graham.
Yeah, I will happily admit, back then, I wasn't the easiest of children or brothers. I wanted, for my love of golf kind of disappeared. Love of the job was kicking in, but then my love of the pub was also taking over. But so it was a
And you had a pub very close to you, if I remember.
Yeah, it was the Duke of Cambridge, which was my home, really. So it would be okay, so finish work, go to the pub, and then stay there till it closed, wake up, go to work, just roll out of bed.
What a life.
It's not a bad life.
It sounds like my 20s as well.
No. And I used to put stickers on my door if I was really quite drunk. I just put a sticker saying, "Dad, I'm really, really drunk tonight. Can I just go full raking bunkers?" And that was my favourite job, raking bunkers.
Yeah.
I just go out there and just, yeah, completely.
You do well to have an accident drunk raking bunkers.
Yeah, exactly. That's very true.
Not
yeah.
that we're like on the Badgers podcast. we're not promoting that anyone in this day and age should ever go to work intoxicated.
No, but then it kind of changed. I did my level 3 at Hankley, and then the love was really growing quite quickly for it, and I wanted to, you know, step up further. I was always the kind of youngster. When you start as the apprentice or work experience guy at Queenwood, I knew I was never really going to climb through the ranks of about 20 guys. Mm-hmm. So I knew I had to move about for that. So
we had Andy Ewens in the podcast mm-hmm. say the exact same thing, you know?
Yeah, so it's just, you think, well, I need to go and get a bit more experience. So worked with you guys for mm-hmm. 3 years. And then I went to Wisley. I did 7 months there. And then I went to East Berkshire for a year before going over to Basingstoke. So moved around quite a bit, but just kind of chasing the roles. I wanted to move up, get more experience kind of thing.
So we'll come at the end of the podcast, we'll come on and talk about Basingstoke because you've got a huge, huge story to tell there.
Yeah.
So how about you, Graham? Growing up, what are your biggest memories of growing up at Hankley?
Biggest memories. I mean, I've actually got a couple of really weird, like, tiny memories of North Mid. I mean, they're just vague ones, remembering seeing Dad out cutting fairways and that. But I think for Hankley, I think the ones I remember most were things like sort of cycling around the course in the morning. I'd pull pins for him if he was cutting greens. I remember one particular morning I was pulling pins and he was spraying seaweed, which meant I got a lot of questions at school as to why I came to school stinking of seaweed.
Mm. It's one of my favourite smells, though. Still.
Yeah, it's a natural smell.
I do like to take the bottle top off and give it a good...
Even get a taste now, some of the really natural ones. Give them a taste.
So there's like that. I remember the other ones as well were things like... it was a really cool thing, and then I kind of want to recreate it with Dad and my oldest, Toby, and Elsie, my youngest. I remember it was like midsummer. I can't remember how old I was, but it was like hand watering. It was before an event, and so it was myself, Dad, and my dad's father, who I call Grand Apollo because he had a VW Polo, and that just stuck.
Fair days.
And we went hand watering. I just remember he would drop me off with my granda with the little trailer with the hose at 18 green. He'd then go off with a Kawasaki mule and hand water a green. He'd then come pick us up, leapfrog us around. I just remember like the three of us on the mule like driving around together and thinking, this is awesome. This is life.
Pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah, and like now my kids are getting a bit older now. I've taken them into work and that, and I love, it sounds really bad, but I'll get emotional. I'll drive around the course with the two of them sat with me, and it's like, this is mad. It's come full circle now. I'm doing what my dad did, so.
I think it's amazing to be able to do that. I know you've got a young girl, haven't you?
Yeah, got a little daughter, yeah.
So you're maybe a while before you can start to do that. But I mean, I used to take Jesse in top dressing greens at night, and I would put his child seat, strap it into the Tora Workman.
Yeah.
Actually, the Cookie Jar film we made at the Open, one of the kind of opening scenes is me going out with Fletcher and the Gator, and the first time Jenny seen it, she cried her eyes out, you know, because it's pretty, the way that Tom shot it.
It was
amazing, and it means a lot. It's my dream to play golf with my kids. Mm-hmm. I would love that, you know, whether they do or not. I'm never going to force them, but to have them coming to work is huge. I mean, your dad must have just get such a buzz from that as well, like what you're getting just now.
Yeah, I think it was that sort of thing, and there was just so many memories with it, sort of thing. Like, I remember all the little things, like it was a family thing, like the fact that he would be out, because this is back in the days when the late Ian McMillan was the head greenkeeper or course manager at Hankley. I remember there being times when we'd go out, like, it'd be dark at night and Dad would be out verdraining greens in the big 6100 John Deere, which was pinnacle tractor for me as a kid.
Him and your mum had an argument.
Yeah, I remember her driving us out, and I think it was a Vauxhall...
Vectra.
No, it wasn't the Cavalier.
Oh, the Cavalier.
She drove the Cavalier out across the course at 10 o'clock at night and pretty much gave an absolute rollicking to the fact that it was 10 o'clock at night and why you're not home, sort of thing. But to me, it was just, that was, I loved that. I thought it was cool. I mean, I always looked up to him. He was just like, he's getting to do something he loves. Like, I remember this really weird memory, but there was a really different memory. I'd come home from school one day, and one of the things used to have happen at Hankley quite a lot was heathen fires. I just remember walking home from school, and just as I'd sort of come down the little bit of the drive to the house near the first tee, he's come tearing down the part of the bridle track where they've obviously had a heathen fire, and he's got his chainsaw hat on, chainsaw trousers on, the whole lot. I mean, he looks like Fireman Sam. Mm-hmm. He's completely covered in soot and smoke, where he's been out cutting stuff to do with the fire. I'm thinking, there is so much more to this than just cutting grass and stuff. Yeah. I know that you don't deal with fires every day, but it's just that sort of thing. It was like, that was like a depiction of how Dad was like, I want to be like him sort of thing. Yeah. All those sort of cool things he was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're getting there.
He used to be a fireman as well back in
the
day.
Yeah, he was. Oh, did he? Yeah, he was a volunteer firefighter.
Yeah. So good experience to have on a golf course, which he probably didn't really realise until he got to Hankley.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because
he's quite a lot.
Yeah, because he's retained firefighter there. Because I remember, I want to say one of the other guys on the team at Huntley was also retained, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's a few of them. So there were some stories from that.
There were some cracking stories from that. Yeah. So, but
and rescuing hot air balloons off the
that was one. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, the bonus to that was free hot air balloon rides. So we had one guy.
Oh, did you do that?
Yeah. There's a guy who had a really small hot air balloon. I remember one day we were sitting in the garden. And the hot air balloon went over the house. And he said, I think that's Steve's hot air balloon. One way to find out. So we just shouted up to him. And the head popped over. How are you doing?
Is that right?
Yeah. So one day he took me and Graham into our air balloon. We thought, oh, it's going to be brilliant. And there was four of us in the basket. It's quite small. One of them was quite an old chap. And we found
what age were you then?
I would have been about 15, 14.
Yeah, because I think I was definitely working at Hankley at the time because there was times I'd go out because it was his hobby. Because I remember Steve saying to me when I used to help him do the recovery out on the course, he's like, the only reason I've got a hot air balloon is because helicopter insurance is too expensive.
Yeah.
And then, you've been like an apprentice or something close to that, sort of starting off sort of thing.
Was that the one where the guy skydived out the basket?
Yeah, old boy, in his 60s, yeah.
So he just jumped out the basket.
Had a backpack on, he just sort of sat up on the top of the basket and went, right, see you later. Bang, rolled back and he was gone.
I remember it was a really windy day and we got up there, we said, oh, this is brilliant, look at the views you can see, but since it was quite windy, it was quite difficult to land, and I think it was about 2 hours or something. We were out there for quite a long time and it was a bit like, oh, look, another field, and we're like, it's getting a bit boring now, can we and of course we got the parents who are following us in the car just driving, waiting for us to land so they can drive us home again. So it was really good, and then after a long time you're thinking, no, actually I'm done now, I want to go, I want to get down and go home.
Yeah, so it just kept going further and further.
Yeah, because they've got like a map. So they'll have a map of like the county, the area, and they'll have all the fields and maps blocked off in colours based upon. It's like, I'll get a bollock and if I land in that field, I'll get a bollock and if I land in that field. That one's okay. That one used to be okay. So
because Gareth, you would give them, I'm guessing, a bollock and when they land in a fairway or whatever, because it would damage it.
So I mean, weirdly, it was that sort of thing. The balloon itself was fine. It was when they came. So the biggest one was Virgin Balloons because they come with that massive touristy hot air balloon. They'd come in, and what would happen is they'd have this entourage of vehicles of all the...
Oh, right.
Okay. And they would just drive through the heather, they'd drive across the fairways. I remember Dad completely losing his mind at them sort of thing. And they're like, oh, we'll give you a free voucher. And he's like, I don't want that. Just don't drive across the fairways in the heather.
And they were literally just cut locks on gates. They were an hour. Come up to farms and there was a gate on it, they just cut it open and get through. They wouldn't care.
Jesus.
Yeah, so just money's been made, isn't it?
And that was the thing, because Steve, because it was his own personal balloon, he took pride in it. Like, he was very respectful. Like, he'd call, he'd say, oh, I'm flying this way. Is it okay if I come and land over on Hankley sort of thing? But no worries. So we go help him out, grab a pint.
And there was a shooting range at the back of the common as well, was there?
It's the training area for the MOD.
Yeah, the DZ,
So Hankley was on 300 acres of land, but
that's
Hankley...
Oh, sorry, the course was, sorry.
But they own over 900 acres, so the MOD had the rest of it. So we'd be out, and there were some fun evenings out. We used to always play the four-hole loop right outside the house and the clubhouse. And we were out, I was standing on the fourth ladies tee. I was very young, couldn't hit the ball very far. And my dad went, oh, look behind you. And there's a bridle path kind of left of the third. And there's just about 20 army guys, all there, full camo, dead still, not moving.
Yeah.
And he's like, they won't move because we're looking at them. So we just sat there and tried to stare them out for ages. Yeah, like, we can see you.
That's scary, isn't it?
It was like, we had it on 12 because you've got the 12th purple tee, which sits behind the bridle track. And I was it wasn't old, that tee, but we would hand cut the tees there because they were smaller. I remember cutting it and then being like four or five soldiers laying on their chest with their SA-80 assault rifles, like across the tee, obviously, because we're kind of on that sort of grey area. They do the land there and we use the land there. And like, I'm just pissing myself thinking, I'm cutting a tee and I've got like these guys in war games just like 10 foot from me with guns waiting to take their shots.
And then all the shells all over the tees that we'd go and pick up
afterwards.
Smoke
grenades as well.
Smoke grenades. We used to find loads of stuff around the course.
Yeah. Mortars. Remember, Dad used to dig up mortars as well.
Yeah, oh, loads of mortars. Yeah, we had a collection of them at the house.
Oh, Jesus.
And there was, when they were putting in that 12 purple tee, they were digging down and what they weren't, what I think he might
be. That was the SO pipeline.
I think he probably knew about the pipeline, but not how close it was. So he's digging near a pipeline. Not near enough for his new damage.
Well, they're never on the map where you think they are.
So he started digging, but they've obviously known there's action going around there. So there was a helicopter circling above them within a few hours. Like, what are you doing near our pipeline?
Is that right?
Yeah. It's the main SO fuel pipeline for, I think, was it Heathrow or Gatwick?
So that runs beside the Berkshire, doesn't it?
Because it runs past Swinney as well.
Yeah, Moggy told me that there's a helicopter goes up and down that line all day checking it just to make sure.
Yeah, because I think what it is, I think it was one of the guys at Landmark told me, I think if that helicopter lands, that's going to cost you tens of thousands of pounds. Mm. So basically, as long as that thing's flying, you're fine. If it lands where you are, that's when you're paying the big bucks.
And your dad was out digging near that pipe.
Yeah. He was building the tee, yeah.
So, yeah, they were just like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? So, yeah, luckily it didn't come to anything, but they just were a bit suspicious of a big excavator near a very expensive pipeline.
Yeah,
exactly, yeah.
And that's the 12th tee is the one that kind of backs onto the corner. You're playing back towards clubhouse.
That's the one.
You've got the par 3 that sort of runs sort of parallel to the sort of border of the common and the golf course. And then, 12 is the one you head back towards sort of the main club.
Because I'm not sure if we maybe talked about this the last time you were on the podcast, but the magical night we had when we were up to watch Skyfall being filmed. Never forget that, and apologies to anyone listening if we talked about it. I'm not going to bother again. Anyway, we went up and watched it, but that must have been amazing as well, having that on your doorstep. Yeah.
Because they've done a few of those, because there was Skyfall, The World Is Not Enough was filmed there as well. Mm-hmm. So if you remember World Is Not Enough, there's a scene where... Robbie Coltrane, because it's his caviar factory, and they've got the helicopter, the circular saw blades that cuts the BMW in half.
All right.
So that the bit when Coltrane gets pushed in the caviar pools, whatever, that was all at Hankley as well.
Jeez. Yeah, so, amazing childhood memories.
Yeah.
We're very lucky. Yeah. You don't realise how lucky it is to have all that land and all those amazing stories until you kind of grow up and see other things. You think, oh, it's just a Parkland golf course. There are no movies for getting filmed here or anything.
Yeah.
There's no army. Where's the army? That was just standard life for us growing up. Yeah,
very, very lucky.
Yeah, and that was the thing for me. Like, friends wanted to, like, you bring friends over. Normally, you bring friends over to play on like your PlayStation or play in the garden. But for us, it was you'd go out in the common, you go around the golf course, you go see all the machines, sort of thing. It was like it was different for them too. That was always what my friends wanted to come and see, sort of thing. And
so you were popular at school because of that.
I was never popular. I was different, which is just what I am now.
It was always like at my school. It was always the farm boys that were popular because everyone would go and play up there, and it was fascinating, and there was big tractors and stuff.
So
it's great you can now recreate this for your kids. So tell us, like, so since the last podcast, obviously Greg Easton got the Royal St George's job.
He did smash it
down there, and you were promoted to course manager Hailing, which everyone was absolutely over the moon about.
I always feel like I'm being a big softy for it, but it was really emotional for me. You know, it's kind of like my dad's my hero, so I've always wanted to do that, and I fell into that trap like a lot of people do in their life and careers, where I was like, oh, I've got to be this by this time, I've got to be this by this time. And I got to a point where I was like, it's just irrelevant, and so I thought, I'll ride the wave and I will just take the journey, and ended up with working with Greg at Hailing, and obviously he got Royal St George's, and I'll still remember it, getting that text from saying, I've just accepted the job, time to get your shit together, sort of thing. And it was, he helped me so much with that transition with it, and I still remember it. Like, obviously I came up and helped you at the Open, and that was the best foundation to help me,
because it was about the same time, wasn't it, really?
It was 2 days after, so we finished the Open, drove down with Matt Plessard and Tom Brayley back home, and then I think it was the day after we got back I had my interview, and I thought it went well. I'm not a naturally sort of confident person, I won't big myself up, so I was always like, there's loads of other guys, I don't know what's going to happen. And it really dragged. It took a while to get the feedback from the interview. And I still remember it because it was my dad's birthday. I was cutting the reins of the sidewinder, and it started hammering it down. And I get a text from the Greens chairman. It was, oh, can I give you a call? And I'm sort of thinking,
shout out Matt Williams.
Matt Williams, legend, amazing Greens chairman. And I was like, well, it's 6:45 in the morning. What's he going to call me for? So by this time, it's absolutely smashing it down. So I run for the starter's hut and take the call and that, and he's basically, look, we had this committee meeting last night and we talked about the interview and that, and we'd like to offer you the job. And I was just completely speechless. It was like,
there's not a better feeling, is there, really?
It was just amazing. Like, and all I could think of was like, I can't wait to tell my dad.
Yeah.
So like, and I just remember, like, so I had a chat with him, it's over the moon, you don't need a hammer to wipe the smile off my face. I just remember walking out the starter's hut and walking across the range back to the side one and just screaming at the top of my voice, yeah,
that's class.
So there's definitely dog walkers looking, thinking, what in the hell is he doing? But it was just, it was just amazing. Like, I never thought, looking, if I talked to myself years ago, I never would have thought I'd get a job like this, a course like this.
Well, the things happen for a reason, and it's,
exactly,
you're fully deserving of the job. I mean, it's to following Greg's footsteps, you singing probably from the same hymn sheet, you'll do things your own way still, but
yeah, I mean,
you know what
thing.
Works down there, and so it would be a probably almost a seamless transition for the club and hopefully some of the staff there.
Yeah, that was a big thing for them, is they liked the direction the club was going in. They liked the philosophies that were being brought in to managing and maintaining the course. And like you said, me and Greg were very similar in that sort of thing and wanted to carry that on. And there's not been a whole lot of big changes, really. It's just been everyone's got their different traits and sort of ways they want to do things. The team are really supportive of it, and they've been great as well. So it's just been carrying on with those sort of things. A few extra bits were sort of getting more momentum on, dealing with sea defences with the course based on its location, carrying on with our master plan with Mackenzie and Ebert, which has been amazing, and just carrying on those sort of things, you know, raising the profile of the course, improving things from an ecological point of view, from a golf point of view. And it's just, the club's been amazing. They've been so supportive of that, and it's been really, I'm loving it. I'm loving every minute of it.
You love a project as well, and you're very good at kind of winter works and stuff. What have you been up to this winter?
So we actually went for a bit of a quieter winter. Greg has been amazing, that sort of thing. Project is his thing to a level I've never seen before that you can do in-house. And I don't feel like I've quite got that same sort of confidence that he has, or the experience, because obviously when he was on the podcast, you know, his background in construction and things, he gained that foundation to do that. So I spoke to the club about it and said, look, you know, I'm just coming into the new role. I don't want to bite off more than I can chew. So we dialed down the projects a little bit. So it's been just a couple of small changes that we're improving, bringing in some new forward tees that we're working on. But just doing other things, like just things that I know the members are like, carrying on with a lot of our gorse management, sort of doing some pathway work, bunker rebuilds, so stuff to keep us ticking along, but at the same time addressing some of the smaller stuff that sometimes the members will pick up on that we can carry on improving with. So it's been a good winter so far, and glad to be on sand and shingle with how wet it's been.
Yes, exactly. I know. And do you jump on the digger at all yourself, or?
Yeah, I'm definitely a frustrated shaper. I am in no way a shaper by any means, but I just love it. And again, it comes back to when Dad was, well, when we grew up with Dad. So he used to have this old 1980s 7 or 9 ton Kobelco, and he would just chuck us in it. Like, I remember being 7 years old and just put us in the cab, and it's like, right, this lever does this, this lever does this. If you get scared, just let go and it'll stop. So
yeah, we were very lucky to have that kind of equipment there. And I remember when we were a little bit older and we had it parked next to the house, and we'd go out and we'd cable tie a spoon to the one of the forks in the bucket.
Oh, right.
You'd have to sit, you'd chuck a golf ball down and say, pick up the golf ball with the bucket. So
oh,
that was
so
how
good.
That's probably one of the best training exercises I've ever done.
Yeah.
Mum wasn't very happy. The amount
yeah,
of spoons
she
we went through over the house. But that was a cool little thing just to get used to being very gentle with the controls, very smooth.
So what age were you doing that from?
I mean, I was probably about 14, 15
doing that sort of stuff.
You were already working at Hankley then.
Yeah, I think when we were first sort of, I say, playing with the digger, that probably would have been, we were both kids then. We were both in school when we were first getting a go on the excavator down at the big borrow pit between 8 and 9. But doing that stuff in the garden, that was when we started doing more of the garden project sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the big boys toys thing, I think, like yourself. So I'll try and get the digger as much as I can, or the excavator, because we use that a lot for gorse management, for our construction work, and I love doing that sort of stuff. I mean, like I said, in no ways am I a shaper, but I like to get better at it.
Exactly,
sort of
same as me. I my favourite thing is to sit in the digger and create stuff. I love doing it, and I want to get a lot better. I want to find someone to teach me to do it.
Yeah.
Everyone's so busy, you know, like to try and get someone of my shaper friends that could give me a day of their time is pretty much impossible.
No, I know what you mean. Like, my thing for me is, like, obviously watching Greg was a big thing.
Greg's very, very handy.
Greg's immense at it. Like, honestly, like, he could be a shaper in his own right. He's fantastic with it. I know he's missing our excavator now. He's at Royal St. George's. But, like, there was that. There was George Waters, who did the shaping for us at Camberley. He actually worked on the restoration at Pinehurst. And I would just watch him, just watch how he worked, watch how he was doing the intricacies, how he would do all those sort of things. But every time I talk to shapers, it's just the same thing. It's practice.
It is. It's just hours on seat. And there's some, I mean, Instagram pages. Is it McKee?
Yeah, we saw Callum before we came here.
Yeah, I'd love to meet him.
Callum's awesome. Lovely guy.
I always, like, creep about on his page and leave him pervy comments about how much I dig his stuff, pun intended. But it's mesmerising to watch some of these guys.
It's so good. It really is.
It's like an extension of their own arm sort of thing.
Yeah.
You watch what they're doing, and Yeah, I think it is practice. Like, we were doing a small bridge build thing on 15 just because of all the rain working.
Well, I watched your one.
Yeah.
You did. I did that.
I thought, I really shouldn't be posting this because I'm not as good as them.
This is why I asked, because I thought it was quite impressive. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, it was just practice sort of thing. Like, it was, oh, here's a chance to use the excavator. I'm going to go and do that sort of thing.
So you've got a tilt rotate.
Yeah, we've got a roto tilt R2 on it. So right, okay.
I've got an Encon.
Yeah, because I don't know, I'm not a shaper, but you've got steel wrist, Encon, I think roto tilt, I think they're the three main ones. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
Nox, just, Nox as well, I think.
Oh, Nox is, I've never, I've not heard
that one. Only know because I was at lab to Rob Griffiths. He's got a load of diggers and all sorts of stuff. He's got the most amazing shed I've ever seen. I take the kids up every year for a visit and show them around and see the alpacas and stuff that he's got. But his son, and this is a great thing as well, his son's 20-year-old, Jack, and he's been doing it since he was 9-year-old. He's sitting in a digger since he was 9.
Yeah.
And you want to see him. He does all our screening and stuff, and he's just amazing. The way, I think a good digger operator is someone that can kind of plot their way around it so they can put themselves in the right positions.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Because you can soon get yourself hemmed in, or you've really got to think about the job that you're doing, whether that's grappling out gorse, or shaping a walkway even, or whatever,
or even
screening, you know, you're sitting up on top of the pile. I mean, I've got braver with a digger. I mean, I sit up on top of the compost heap, which is essentially grass and sand, soil, and all sorts of stuff. And I think, like Adam, who works with us, is always like, "Bled, you're an absolute maniac." Adam, apologies.
That'd be a spot on.
It sounded like John McLaughlin, didn't it?
Yeah.
Good John Mack.
But it shows how important those tools are, because when you've had that roto tilt bucket in, we've seen the shapers, and then you hire another digger, which is a fixed bucket, you think, how many things are flat and straight on a golf course? Hardly anything.
Yeah, exactly.
So you realise how important it has to have these kind of equipment, and how lucky we are to have the technology to really shape around with it.
Yeah.
But do you know, I played golf with Kai Gobe, who shaped the tree farm, and he's Tom Doak's, one of Tom Doak's main shapers. Dad won the Masters.
Oh, wow.
Amazing guy. Okay. I played one round deal, and he shaped tree farm with a fixed bucket, and intentionally done it with a fixed bucket because he wanted it to look rugged and no smooth lines.
I get that, because if you've got a rototilt, you'll be inclined to smooth everything off and make everything graded and gradual sort of thing. I get that.
So it was all about just putting these tracks in the right position, and and I guess using the wee foot pedal that brings it closer and
I guess you could do that and use the blade to sort of pivot yourself a little, angle it a bit more. But the thing is, saying that with the excavator stuff, I mean, you were definitely better than I was when I was younger. Because you went on the Wisley and did a lot of work there.
Yeah, I was obsessed about being the digger. I loved it. So any chance I got to be in it, I just sat there for ages. So you did a bit, shaped up some bunkers, but that was just on a tilt bucket with the left pedal. So I remember going home at night and just leg just in bits from trying to very gently press this pedal just to slightly get that 1/4-inch tilt just to get that final finish.
All right,
you get obsessive about it because, like you said, watching all these videos of amazing shapers, I want to do that. Mm. And you just keep practicing and practicing and practicing until you can get it.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, I think you said it before, Pledge, once you get a job to try and dedicate yourself into that machine, you just haven't got time to do it.
If you're sitting, I've spent last Thursday, Friday, in the digger building a scrape in our fifth, and that's 2 days that I've lost.
Yeah.
So whenever Adam's away with the dump truck, dumping off, I'm on my emails or phoning people. But I still kind of think that's one part of practical work that I want to hold on. I'm quite greedy way.
Yeah. I'm the exact same.
But I actually want to get better at it.
Yeah. I'll be honest, there's been times, say, when I finish work, it's a case of, I know Flick's at work, I know the kids are at school and nursery, I'm going to play about in the yard with the excavator for a little bit and just do a bit of practicing with it sort of thing.
But I think for me, that's a great thing about living on site, is I got Phil our mechanic, to put a big light bar on our digger, which we've got an 8-tonner, and it literally light up the whole yard. And Chris, you can muck about in there all night. It's just Jenny shouting, "Come in." So I think this maybe brings us on beautifully, transition to your job, Scott.
Yeah.
And obviously diggers, which has been quite prevalent in your life.
We've had a few machines on site the last year and a half. Yeah.
To take us right from, let's find out about how you got the job.
Yep.
And how the new course came about. And then let's talk us right the way through.
Yeah. So, long story long. I went to Basingstoke back in 2017. There was a deputy position came up. So, very lucky career. Worked at Queenwood, Hankley, Wisley, East Berkshire. And I went to Basingstoke, which is a 100-acre golf course on pure clay, pretty much. And it wasn't the nicest golf course in the world to me in my eyes, because I was spoilt for where I've been beforehand. But I knew that there was this chance of the course relocating. So it all started back in the 80s, where the council said they wanted to buy the land for property development. And the members have been humming and hawing about it for years and years. I think it was 2007, the members finally agreed, yes, we're going to sell the golf course. And then through years and years of trying to find out where they wanted to go, 2 years after I was there, they said, right, we're going to move. And they were going to go to Test Valley Golf Club down the road. And they were going to build a 27-hole golf complex, build the whole thing. And then once it's finished, shut the lights off, move over. But the members didn't like it. We had to have another EGM to vote whether we wanted that or not. And they voted very strongly against it. So then the next proposal was a golf course called Dummer, which is 1 mile from the gates of Basingstoke Golf Club. And at the closest point, it was only 140 metres away. So we ended up selling our golf course at Basingstoke Kempshot, we call it, for 50-odd million pounds. And buying Dummer Golf Club, which is 1 mile away, 160 acres on pure chalk for 4.5 million. So it's quite a good business venture for the club.
So was that a proprietary owned club?
Members owned golf club.
So that would have had to go into the members.
Yeah.
Do you fancy selling?
Lots of big meetings, lots of...
And you'll get a mega upgraded golf course out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And so not only is there a massive amount of money that's been able to be put into buying another golf club, because the members could have just voted to sell the golf club, take the money and run. But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to keep a legacy. They wanted to keep the golf club. But they still get, we call it the distributions of the money. Basically, I think it's about just under 50% of the money they got from the golf club is distributed to all the members. So they're still waiting to get that once we've liquidated the company, but they're going to get quite a nice little penny out of
it. So half the money goes to building the new course and the clubhouse, and half goes to the members' pockets?
Kind of. I don't know the exact details of how the money gets split up exactly, but we were basically, the members voted on a budget for the project. So they said £20 million is your budget, which is an absurd amount of money. But it was a lot more money back in 2017 when they agreed it, between 2021 when we started the project. Of course, we had a pandemic, there was a war. We were seeing prices increase between 35 and 40%. So we had to rethink the whole budget, a lot of valued engineering. I mean, pipe work for the irrigation had gone up by 35%.
Yeah. It just blew up, didn't it?
Oh, just ridiculous. So there's no
steel work for all your buildings. Oh.
Yeah, well, the clubhouse is meant to be two floors. They had to take out a complete floor of the clubhouse because it was just too expensive. So it's no one now on one floor. So 2021, July, we finally broke ground after eventually getting the planning permission to do so. So before that, we moved over to the golf club, obviously two sets of greenkeeping teams. Everyone had to reapply for their jobs. And I was very fortunate to come out as course manager from that. So it was it wasn't the nicest time to be in the job, but I was very lucky coming out of it in the end. So. We have a great team that came out of it, very happy. And
how many in your team?
So we've got 8 guys at the moment. We're looking to go to 10 this spring. Mm-hmm. So watch this space. There's going to be some upgrades happening.
Will there be a job advert going out?
There'll be a job advert going out. So we want to get some more guys involved. We've kind of been pushing with the club, saying we're raising the standards, we're raising the bar. We need to make sure we have the resources to do that. Mm-hmm. So with that, we want a bigger team out there to look after this what will be a great golf course.
And we can, at the end, when we get to the end of this, you can talk about all your facilities and stuff, and we'll sell someone this job.
Yeah, I'm sure, hopefully. So it's lucky. So to break down the project, we've kind of got Asian tees and putting in 2 new water storage lagoons. Mm. We've got the buildings where we've got new greenkeepers compounds, new clubhouse, the new driving range. And then there's the driving range project, which we're actually doing a soil imputation project. So we've got about 110,000 cubic meters of material going in, which is about, I think, 11,000 lorries, 12,000 lorries. So that just started in October. So the course pretty much finished, a lot of snagging to do. We're hoping to get some members out playing in that this summer.
So have you got 100% grass coverage?
No, we probably did the seeding was completed about September, October. Just before the winter. So it's there.
Just enough to pop and then hold the soil together.
Exactly that. Yeah. So we did see a bit of damage from the rain. I mean, we've had unbelievable amounts of rain. And
Is there a drainage system in the fairways and everything?
Pure chalk didn't need it. So we've got drainage on the greens, USGA spec greens.
So the chalk was shaped, topsoil was stripped, chalk was shaped, topsoil was laid back on.
Yep.
Dozers or diggers?
Both. Okay. Both, yeah, we've had dozers, diggers, we've had the big six-wheeler 30-ton rock trucks, we've had everything.
That's awesome, isn't it?
It was brilliant.
Yeah, I really wish I had all that.
Yeah. And did you go down much to visit them, did you?
We went in a few times, Nat, yeah. I think we're both would have quite happily taken up an offer to go and jump in a D6.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't play golf while you're doing this.
Yeah, right.
So after I don't know how many different plans and phases that we went through to try and make this happen, we finally came down to one, which was a 9-hole interim golf course. It's not a temporary golf course. You've got to call it interim.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it's just temporary tees, temporary greens, 9-hole golf course. It's 6 par 3s. It's 3 par 4s. Call a spade. It's a picture putt golf course.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that special, but it's allowed the members to play golf and see what it takes to build a golf course. And I think they've all been completely blown away by how much it what it takes to produce these surfaces.
How many members are there now that they've joined?
So we've got 600 members roughly from Basingstoke, the original golf course. They all came across. And then we've inherited, I think, between 180 to 200 from the golf club that we purchased.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all very keen to stay on. We know there's a couple hundred members that are hanging on for the big payout. We haven't seen them for years and years and years.
Could you imagine you just joined and no more? You were the last person in and then that happened.
Yeah, exactly. So, there's some people who can do very, very well out of it. But luckily, the majority of the members are focusing on the golf course. That's a big thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's been some real challenges that's going through this project, just one after the other.
Well, I did a growing at G West and then one in Sweden. I think what Strutty used to always say, if you can get through this job, then everything will be easier after this.
I think it's the reason that I'm the one out of three of us has got no hair.
Mm.
Yeah, so completely
yeah,
gone.
Yeah, it could be that.
Yeah, I mean, on top of that, on a personal note, like, I didn't time it very well, so I think I became a dad, a course manager, and a husband, and started rebuilding a golf course in the space of 12 months.
Jesus.
So that was a fun year.
Fire by fire.
Yeah, exactly. And I even remember saying to my wife, you know, when we were just going out as a couple, probably 3 or 4 years ago, probably thinking a bit too far ahead, I said, look, at some point we're going to want kids, but I know this project's coming up, and I don't want to clash the two together, because that would be a stupid idea, wouldn't it? Having a baby, yeah. And then here we are. So, but no, it's been fantastic. And like I said, well, my wife's actually a member, which... it's a bit of a contradictory thing. I'm going out for lady member.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but it's great having her there and seeing her out playing golf on this 9-hole interim golf course with the pram and the baby in it.
That's awesome. I'm getting feedback. You were showing me some of the pictures last night. They're really, really cool.
Obviously, little Pippa, my daughter, she absolutely loves seeing the diggers. So she's obsessed with that now. So it's been really good. Really good.
So talk us through your grass species that you've got from green to tea.
So we've gone for Creeping Bent on the greens, so that's the big one we wanted to go for, raise the bar. I've been very fortunate to work with Creeping Bent at Queenwood and Wisley, and we put it to the club, and they said they really want to go for it. So Pure Distinction, Pure Select, and then we've gone for a fine rye fescue mix on all the tees, aprons, fairways, and then pure fescue in the rough areas. So
excellent. So seeding rates, do you know, can we discuss seeding rates?
I try and pull out the figures, but I'll be honest, I've got numbers everywhere in my head and I just can't remember anything.
I'm pretty sure now we used to go like 40, 48 grams on fairways and 18 or something, 10 in roughs.
Yeah, I mean, off the top of my head, I've got a spreadsheet with all these little details going through, because I'm like, this will be important one day, I'll need this. But yeah.
If you trust me, you ask the stupid.
yeah, exactly. But yeah, we're very happy with the seed that we went through. The Creeping Bent's going to be a bit controversial to some people. I did a lot of research. I spoke to quite a few people, especially the ones that have got experience in managing it. And anyone who's managed Creeping Bent have said to me, you have to go Creeping Bent. You have to go for
it. It's beautiful grass.
Oh, it's so good.
And have you managed to keep it clean so far?
We got hit badly by take all patch last summer.
Right.
So my big argument about going for this was about disease management for the future. Yes, there is maybe more thatch getting produced by it, but I can manage thatch, but I'm not sure how much longer that we can manage disease. So we've only put down 3 fungicides in the space of about, 16 months now?
That's good.
So probably should have put down one more, but I'm trying. It's that balance where I want to almost experiment to see how much we need to put down, but at the same time, it's not my experiment. It's a golf course I'm trying to produce for the members. So
I think you'll learn more and more about the place I keep a little black book for all of the mistakes that I feel that I've made, and then I put it in months. So then when I'm coming to next year, I can, like just now, I'll start to look into March. I'll look at what happened then, and then exactly just what you've said.
Yeah,
I think that you won't be the only greenkeeper that said stuff like that, you know.
So it's the kind of thing where, because it's a brand new golf course, I can't think back to, oh, well, last year it did this. I haven't got that evidence from previously, especially these days. It's all about data. Collect as much as you can, and it just helps. But normally it's a case of, you go out on a rainy day, you look at one green, you see a puddle, and you know how the rest of the golf course is, because you know where the water sits, and that kind of gauges your mindset for the rest of the golf course. But we're, as a team, we're all starting fresh on that. We're learning the strengths, the weaknesses, the things we need to watch out for and we don't have to worry about.
And are the USGA spec greens?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And Poa? Much problem with Poa, Anya?
So far, so good. The one I've always said about this, yeah, touch wood. The one I've always said about this is that we haven't got a team of 20, 30 guys.
Yeah.
I'm going to be realistic about this. We're very lucky that we've got the RNA involved, Simon Watson coming. He was brilliant. And
Is he your agronomist?
Yes, right. Yeah. So he was a little bit worried. He was saying about the creeping bent. I said, look, if we get Poa, we're going to get Poa. We're surrounded by fields. Mm-hmm. We're surrounded by all these grasses. I'm not going to sit here and say we're going to have pure creeping bent grass for the end of time. It may come in. The main target is to make sure that we have true, healthy, good playing surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And if it means you get a bit of Poa in there, we're going to get a bit of Poa. We'll do our best to manage it. And, you know, we'll learn through that through time.
Mm-hmm.
But I went over to visit the Grove and they've got creeping bent, which I think was from back in the 90s they seeded maybe. And they had quite a lot of Poa, but the greens were spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unbelievable. So it's a bit of a mindset thing where we just have to be realistic of what we can do.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing. I mean, your options are picking it or dabbing it.
Yeah,
exactly. Pretty much, you know, we don't have a chemical. Yeah.
And I don't think the members will be too chuffed of us out there doing all these kind of activities or spending loads of money on labour to try and manage it. So,
well, we'd in Norway, we worked with a team of five Polish guys. And on the first week, the boss wanted me to take them out with the dabbers. Mm-hmm. So for anyone that doesn't know what a dabber is, it's a kind of cylindrical tube full of Roundup with a little sponge in the bottom, and you just walk about and dab anything you want to kill. So trying to teach Polish guys that had never seen a golf course before in their life the difference between poor and creeping bent.
Yeah.
And whilst managing them at the same time, making sure they're dabbing the right bits. Yeah, they got a bit excited at times.
Yeah, I bet.
Looked like a polka dot green, brown and green. It's funny.
Yeah, so we're very happy with what we've done. I mean, the big one was we were actually seeding the greens. The latest green we've seeded was the first week of October back in 22, yes.
Mm.
And I remember sitting there, we're seeding it, and I was like, I'm not sure this is a good idea, guys. I'm really not sure it's a good idea. You know, everyone says, if you're going to seed, do it spring. Don't do it just before winter.
Mm-hmm.
But they have been unbelievable going through the winter.
And you can just overseed into them, you know?
Well, exactly. Yeah. And the thing is, we got into spring, we had a very late spring last year. The soil temperature didn't go up till, I think it was early, if not middle of May.
Mm-hmm.
And we're there going, oh, they're a bit slow. And it was almost like overnight, they just matured. And it was unbelievable seeing it. We were seeing weeds everywhere, and I'm thinking, oh, here we go, it started. And literally, night and day, within a space of a few days, once they just got that condition, they filled out, just the creeping bent took over everything. And it just disappeared, and it went pure.
And what's your nutrition program on them?
At the moment, it's just going quite heavy with everything. We did the testing back in September. We're keeping it hard and well-fed through the winter. Going to go really heavy this spring on the fine rye fescue areas, because we want to try and get that thatch. Mm-hmm. And that's a weird thing. You spend the last 15 years of my career saying, right, we need to try and get rid of this thatch.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're there going, right, what you've got to do now is produce thatch. It's just completely backwards. And then slowly, you know, get the feed in there, get it growing nice and fast, build that thatch, and then slowly just start tailing that off, really. So
next year will be a big year for you then?
Hopefully,
When are we looking at opening?
So, like I said, our main objective this year is to get the members on that golf course in any capacity. There'll be some restrictions. We've got lots of stones that we've got to worry about, but that's just going to be time just building on top of those. The soil importation is due to finish the end of this year, so we can get the driving range finished. So we're looking, next year will be the big marching band fireworks and get you guys down for a game of golf.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, sounds good.
So yeah, it's a long way to go, but it's going to be good, and we're very lucky we've got Bruce Weller, our architect, who's
So let's talk about him, because I think this is the Badger's not here, as we know just now.
Yeah, he'll be desperate to know about this sort of stuff,
and he'll be raging if I've not touched on the architecture side. So let's hit on that.
I mean, Bruce Weller, he was actually appointed by the club before I started. I was hired in 2017. That's how early this goes back with the tender process.
Jeez.
And so Bruce Weller, I knew actually as a junior golfer, because he was a member at Hankley. So, yeah, which he didn't really remember me playing golf in those days. We had some funny stories. But Bruce has come in. He's helped with the trying to get around the the challenge of getting the golfers out there. We sat down at the very beginning and I put it straight in front of him. I said, look, this is your golf course design. You're the expert here. I'm going to let you do that. But if I can't maintain it, I can't let you build it. We need to make sure we have that balance. And he's been brilliant working with me on that sort of area, just making sure that we got every box ticked, that we're not being too flamboyant with some of these areas, but we're still getting that really nice style that we want to make a bit of a wow factor with. So one of the big design elements that he's put in, which we absolutely think is fantastic, is we've got our own mini white cliffs of Basingstoke, we're calling them, just to expose what the raw material is that we're built on. And we're going to cover that with all this wildflower and creeping thyme, which is an idea that he's got, which is going to be really interesting.
Yeah, that's quite niche, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And who does he work for? Is he
Weller Designs, yeah, his company. So him, he's got a twin brother, David. And also they've got a new member of staff they hired just last year, which is my wife. So yeah, keeping it in the family. So yeah.
So she does card.
Yeah, so she got made redundant on the last week of her maternity leave, which was a bit of a rough time for us with everything going on. And I was chatting to Bruce about it and he said, what does she do? I was like, oh, she's a close girl. She's not for golf. Do you reckon she'd come and have a chat? And now she's working 3 days a week in the office, and all those times she'd say to me and Graham, my dad, oh, you boys just chat shop all the time. And now she's there going, so can you just say that again, just so I can make a note of this, and drainage plans and getting all this stuff done. So yeah, she's absolutely loving it, which is great to have.
Because I imagine the Christmas dinner table at the Roberts house, if it's up in Huntley, it was quite an interesting place.
It's like mini Harrogate, really, isn't it?
So, we used to be, not so much nowadays, but the joke with us used to be, oh, Mother's Day, right, Mum, for Mother's Day, we're going to go out for dinner at the Duke of Cambridge, and we're not going to talk about greenkeeping, and we'd probably get to starters coming out, and we're back on it.
I give it 30 seconds. It doesn't. I mean, even I'll say it, right, we need to stop talking shop, we're not going to do this. What are your greens doing at the moment? How are they doing? Exactly. Can't help but do it. You just, yeah. So
my Jenny's become a lot more tolerable now.
Yeah, but she's on that side of it. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to listen to your podcast with obviously Lee and Sammy the day keeping it the family. And yeah, so it's nice to have it. So I don't feel as guilty now talking about work, because she actually has to listen and, you know, take it in. So it's good. It's really good.
That's super. And do you don't live on site, do you?
No, I'm only about 5 minutes away. So I'm not far away, but we haven't got a house on site, no, which I think is good, because I'm there a lot. I've luckily got a very, very patient wife who's put up a lot over the last year and a half.
It's long hours, isn't it, and growing?
Yeah. I'm quite firm with some of the things. I don't do stupid hours. I'm lucky that I don't actually do weekends unless...
Recharge time.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I am guilty for taking my work home with me. I've always got my emails on my phone and taking phone calls, because I think you used to make a joke about me saying, oh, Scott, he's a briefcase greenkeeper. He's always in the office kind of thing, which is a term which has now gone on really nice into my club, which my general manager, David, and Tom in the office, and Max all have to call me the briefcase greenkeeper, because I'm just always on my phone doing emails and meetings. And it's annoying. I feel guilty for the team. I've not actually been out there too much, but it's just...
Well, there's so much planning for you.
I've not been a greenkeeper for a year and a half, is the honest truth, with this project going on. So we are very excited to get a golf course back and go back to the routine and start using all these brand new tools that we have.
So tell us about your new facility.
Yeah. So we're very lucky, a part of the whole project, we get a brand new greenkeeper's facility. So I've been trying to work on designs of this for about 4 years, trying to make sure we're getting something that's right. And as you can imagine, with all the varied engineering we did, making cutbacks in certain elements, the first place they're going to go is the greenkeeper's compound. So, which I understand, you know, it's not the end of the world. As long as we're still getting something, you know, new, is going to be great. The luckiest thing is that the current greenkeeper's compound is actually blocking part of the clubhouse car park construction. So they had to do our building first. Otherwise, I know full well, if it was done last, we know it may not have the building we have now. So I could go in and I can make quite a few comments about, oh, it should have been this, it should have been bigger, it should have been that. But how many greenkeepers get to say they've got a brand new facility? So it's a cracking building. We've got a nice solid brushed concrete padding outside, so there's no muddy areas. Everything's nice and solid, nice aggregate bays. I try to make it like a factory line. So you walk in the new building, straight away on your left is the drying room. So on a wet day, take off your wet gear, put it in there. Then you go through to the locker room, boots off and everything. And then you can go upstairs where we've got our staff room and the office. Very lucky to have a general manager who's really been supporting the internals for that. So we're not just getting the leftovers from the clubhouse. It's brand new chairs, desks, computers, everything that's going to really show the standard that we want. And having that facility is such a motivator for everyone.
Oh, massive.
How many guys, we've all worked in a building where you go in and it's just freezing cold. You're lucky to have a heat, you're lucky to have hot water. and to have this.
I've seen some horrendous sheds at that time. So we were quite lucky to an extent. We've got good storage sheds, but like the offices and canteens really need an upgraded. How about yourself, Graham? How's your place?
Yeah, so that same as you, our building's pretty decent sort of size. The room we're in here right now is actually probably about the same size as our old break room. We were a team of 9 full staff, so just before I came in, Greg had got a sort of converted shipping container into a mess room. And again, functionally, it's totally fine. It does the job, but it's not efficient. And so we're trying to sort of work towards getting an extension that basically the ideal world would be everything under one roof, same as Scott. It's about flow, it's about efficiency sort of thing. So
it's about and being together with a team. I think half my battle is I'm across in the house.
Well, that's kind of things like my office. We're saying my office now. My office is in like the main machinery part, but our break room is literally the opposite side of the yard. So you've got to walk about 100 yards across the yard to get to the guys, and I don't like that because you want to be all together sort of thing. I don't like that sense of separation sort of thing.
Mm. But I used to love it in Deal. You remember our office in Deal? You'd have to walk past it.
Yeah, exactly. I
so
think
everyone would be like,
yeah.
morning Bledge.
Yeah, exactly.
Quite like it. I've got my office right next to the staff room, and we've got a nice brand new big 55-inch TV as well, which is all linked up to the PC. So getting away from the whiteboards and paper, it's all done on phones and
There's nothing wrong with a whiteboard.
I love a whiteboard.
We're going a bit techy at some of the things, but it's all the other thing we've really tried to focus on is future-proofing it as well, because they're not going to redo this again in 10 years, 50 years if we're lucky. So we've got compressor points everywhere and electric points everywhere, because we've got quite a lot of electric machinery coming soon. Mm-hmm. And there's no secret that we're going to be seeing a lot more in the future. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to make sure that we can charge any machine from any point in the facility. Mm-hmm. So just now, if we're making a mess now, make a real mess and do it properly.
Yeah, I mean, especially where you've got the money to do it as well.
Wow, exactly. Yeah. You have to be spending it in the right places now.
This is exciting stuff for you both, and a great story. Lovely to hear, and it's for being two good friends of mine as well. I'm chuffed to pieces that you are doing as well as what you are doing.
Yeah.
It's amazing to see, and Graham obviously came up and helped us at the Open.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was
probably walked a lot of miles.
Sam Norman. Absolutely, I loved working with him. He was amazing. One of the apprentices that won the competition, and he got in touch with me just before BTME, and we've met up in that. And I loved that. That was so
good
to be with
him. He's the ICL scholar.
That's right. Yeah, ICL scholar. Yes, so he got one of that, and I think he was one of the finalists for student greenkeeper.
He came running up for young student greenkeeper.
That's right. Sam was a great lad. It was so good to work with him. Really passionate, really keen, and had a great time with him. But the whole week itself was just immense. Mm-hmm. It was really good week, one of the most memorable weeks I think in my career, sort of thing.
But I owe you some volunteer to an experience shifts now, don't I?
Yeah,
I'm actually going down to help Matt Plested at Stonehard.
I think
it
is
a European one. We're going to do the English one with Matt, so he's going to work me like an animal that week.
Yeah,
so
good stuff. Jobs the other day,
hopefully his pair can come along too.
He's just
thinking of excuses now.
Yeah, exactly.
We're very, very lucky. Matt's just down the road from both of us, isn't he? So, and he's obviously been on here before, chatting about his soil invitation project. So,
having
that knowledge nearby, and like we've got with so many guys in the industry, having these guys willing to share their knowledge.
And Matt's just a legend, anyway. Because your point of view from the project thing, he was my mentor for the FDMI.
Yep, mine too.
That was 10 years ago for me.
Like Grant Frogley. So, he's chatting to him last night. Good to see my mentor.
It's good all full circle sort of thing. Yeah. But it's like, well, Matt was a huge help for me. Matt was a big help, I think, in boosting my confidence in getting the course manager's role, because we shared a bunker bin together. And it was just an ongoing joke with the whole team. We both got young families, so it was, we're getting away, we're going to sleep as much as we can sort of thing. Cut greens, sleep. Wake up, watch golf, cut greens, sleep. And he would just, I remember we'd lay in the bed side by side, like 2 foot apart, and he'd be laying in the bed next to me going, right, Graham, what do you do with this? So, what are you going to say to the committee if you do this for the interview? Well, I'll do this and that. Then suddenly you'd hear the soft noise and he's just passed out and fallen asleep.
That's good.
But Matt's amazing. I mean, he's just so passionate about what he does. And he's so passionate about people, you know, helping people, educating people, helping people. Yeah, he's great like that. You've used him a lot for the project stuff.
Yeah, a huge amount. He's been very handy for us. And I think also to mention, he's got a big charity golf day he's setting up as well. So we're going to get the Roberts clan together and go down to support that, definitely. So
don't stand anywhere 90 degrees of where I'm playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We haven't played golf together for... No, we played at Swinley, didn't we? Me, you.
We played at Swinley just
Who's the better golfer?
Scott.
Dad.
I have not played golf barely in a year and a half. I haven't had time to since becoming a dad. And that I mean, I've lost a lot of love for the game at the moment. But I was at Ganton on Monday. I have to do a shout out to Simon, seeing his course, and that just really has boosted my love for the game, the industry, the job. Yeah, I needed to see that. So that was an awesome one to see.
Yeah,
but
I need to go up and see that.
We're good. Yeah, Dad's always been the best golfer. I've never managed to get below his handicap. He's off technically four. Yeah,
four. I think he's on. Yeah, but I mean, like every year. And I mean, every year, like a lot of people, this is my year, I'm going to get back into golf, which means I'll be saying it again in 25. But I want to get on it because we've both agreed to Matt, we'll play in the charity golf day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know Ali Beggs has invited us up to yours to play at some point. So I need to sort that out. But no, I want to, it's that, like going up the open, seeing all you've got all these friends that play different courses. And I'll always remember the quote you said to Joe on the Talking Greenkeeper about, you know, a chef would always taste his own food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's so true. It's
yeah, exactly. Speak like this and just get information, hear the stories and stuff like that. But no, I need to get back in the game. I think my handicap is technically seven, but it's not. It definitely isn't. Definitely isn't.
I'm a bit gutted that you pair are not arguing about this. I was kind of hoping for a bit of a bus stop between me and
My golf is non-existent. It is absolutely atrocious sort of thing. That's the thing. Yeah. I've never been a good golfer, though.
There was this one where we were playing golf. We were very young at this time. I remember I was at nursery school. And you thought it would be a good idea to put two golf balls down, one in front of the other, and hit them both at the same time.
So one goes miles up in the air.
Oh no, one went straight in my eye.
Oh, did
yeah,
it?
Yeah, straight in the eye socket. Yeah,
I don't remember that. Okay, that's cool. I feel bad now.
It's usually one does go straight and one goes miles up there and spins back.
He didn't put one on top. Sorry, he put one in front and one behind.
Yeah, yeah.
He just came right down in between, straight back into my
eye. Brutal.
There you go. But you clearly got more scarred than that, but I did, because I do not remember that one.
His brothers, you get on well, don't you?
We do.
Best pals.
Chalk and cheese. We are very different people.
Yeah.
I like going out drinking. I'm not the healthiest lifestyle, which you can tell by just a look at me. I look like the older brother with no hair, and I am the younger brother. Just want to make sure.
Yeah, he's definitely the younger brother.
You love the job more than anyone else I know.
Well, the thing is, so when we were younger, I always remember we used to go to the golf clinic at Hankley. So you go up the practice ground, and the pro there would do the same thing. It didn't matter if you're Phil Mickelson or Phil from down the road. You got the same briefing from him on how to hold a golf club.
The grip, the setup, the swing.
I still remember it. Yeah,
same speech every time.
So we do that. We get a Mars bar and a drink from the pro shop. We play four holes. And all I was waiting for was to get done on that fourth green. So I go and see Dad and go and see the machines and go and do something. It was because I love the game. I just wasn't naturally. I didn't have a natural swing like you and Dad did. So for me, I was like, well, I'm crap at this. I'm going to focus on greenkeeping, and I'm ever slightly better at that than I am at golf. And I'm terrible at golf.
And you're really good at making stuff.
Oh yeah,
applications and an inventor.
I'm an inventor. I'm that really the guys at the work do laugh about that, as I'll disappear in the workshop after work sometimes and come out with random inventions and fabrications.
Well,
and
you
stuff.
Made me a blobber down at Deal for the fertilizer spreader because my big thing, and I really wish the companies would make it.
They do make them somewhere, but I can't find them anywhere.
We've always struggled, even when we went to America to get. Yeah. I mean, essentially, it's just a compressor with a fairy liquid. Well,
to be fair with that, I've actually bought more parts to try and make a better version of it, because you can get ones now that can charge up via USB plugs and. I'm on that. I try to think it was that. There was my little thing for rivet bunkers. There was...
Yes, yep. So I'm waiting on one of them.
Yeah.
I'm waiting on...
There's a waiting list,
I need to sort that out. From my granular spreaders.
Yeah, I think it was a couple of other things, but I can't remember what they were. But I don't know. I love problem solving. I think it was like that bridge I had to do on 15 with all this water that's been building up. I like to see something. Well, how can I make something? It's just because... As a kid, my TV was always watching stuff on Discovery Channel, like American Chopper and all that stuff where they build stuff. So, like, I'm a frustrated guy that wants to learn to weld and make and use machines and stuff. So that's just that's what I like to do, sort of thing. So where you were playing golf, I was normally in the workshop at Dad's at Hankley, just making stuff out of stuff, sort of thing. And it very rarely ever worked, but I just like the idea of giving it a go, sort of thing. And, you know, it was just fun, sort of thing.
Every now and then you'll stumble across someone that's a clever wee invention. Right,
yeah. You'll see it in Dragon's Den, stuttering my way through it to Peter Jones.
So we'll put some kind of footnotes on this podcast. So do we have... Did I watch a drone video the other day?
Yeah. If you go on YouTube, Basingstoke Redevelopment. We've got drone footage. I think we've got four or five videos now from it. We've got a member, Barry Coomer, who's done some videos, and they're incredible. They're really good to show the extent of the project, the magnitude.
I watched that the other day, and we loved it. It was good.
We'll put some links up for that so you can see the action, see what's happening.
Let's do that. And both you boys on Twitter, or?
I'm just on Facebook and LinkedIn.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm not the social media guru like you.
I'm not a social media guru. I hate that as well.
Your social media is your CV, pretty much.
Yeah, probably, yeah. People have joked about that. No, I don't do as much as I used to, but yeah, I'm on...
You're a good photographer, so you take
off. Yeah, I enjoy doing that.
You've won the bigger photo award before, no?
No, I came runner-up to my dad.
Sore point.
I'm not bitter, but no, we're trying to call it bigger about that, yeah. So I enter every year, and yeah, the best I've come is runner-up, and it was the year my dad won it.
Always a bridesmaid, never the bride.
Exactly, yeah, that's exactly it. But no, I love it. That's my thing. I think it's a passion thing. I love the photography because it's a means to show people what we do, show people what, you know, where we get to work, and it's special. I love that sort of thing.
And Hankley would have been, is in my mind, is one of the most photogenic golf courses on the planet.
It's just
especially with all the heathers out. And
What a bit of land it was. I mean, the thing is, we weren't just sport with the golf course, the village, where we were was incredible.
Oh, Tilford was amazing. Yeah.
So, you know, from our parents coming from the northeast of Scotland into one of the wealthiest villages in the UK, Surrey. It was a bit strange, really.
Yeah.
Until we had to go and buy our own houses and realise, well, we're not living here, are we?
Yeah, I'm going to Portsmouth.
Yeah.
But I get a feeling, I'm not sure about you, Scott, but from you, Graham, that you see yourself as a Scotsman.
Oh, definitely. I'm a frustrated Scotsman. I don't sound it unless I'm up there, sort of thing.
But you were born where?
I was born in Barnet, of all places.
Barnet,
yeah. So,
Scott, where were you born?
100% Scottish, I always say that. And I'll always say, like, if you had one parent Scottish and one English, you'd be half Scottish, half English.
Yep.
Both our parents are Scottish.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, when it comes to football and rugby especially,
get
the kilt out.
This shows what your personality was like, though, because it was the sort of thing where Six Nations comes along. If you're talking to any of the family or family friends in Huntley, you'll support England till the day you die.
I did like winding them up quite a lot.
You were just to wind up much, and that's all you would do.
I like being the underdog. But yeah, nowadays it's definitely kilt on.
My Fletcher's the same. I never pushed anything on him. If he wanted to support England, if he could have done, and he sees himself as Scottish.
Family,
He doesn't sound Scottish, but he has Scotland tops. And
See, my thing apparently, because I remember it, I went up again. This was about 10 years ago. I went up to Hogmanay to see the family. I took some friends up with me, and I had an L200 truck like I've got now. I had to get new tyres while I was up there. I picked my friend up from the airport.
It was red, wasn't it?
No, that's the one I've got now. Well, the one I've got now is pink,
but it's now red. Silver
now.
One. Yeah.
Yeah, so we've both got matching red pickups, wasn't intentional.
His and his.
Yeah, his and his. So now I had a black one that was nicknamed the Thunder Truck. And I went to this garage to get tyres. And of course, I'm very standing English. And I went to the garage and I picked up from the airport. And like that, went straight sort of Aberdonian sort of accent. I don't even know what I'm doing it.
Fed like.
It's like, are we nearby? Can I get myself a couple of tyres to the back of the truck, please? And it's like, I walk out and my mate is creasing. And I'm like, what are you laughing at?
Scottish, but yeah.
That was like a John Mack level sort of interpretation of accents. But I just, it's that sort of thing. But I think you do it as well, though.
We all do it. And you notice with mum and dad especially, they've still got their accents. You know,
your dad's strong.
Yeah, but now they've
radio
back
chat
there.
At work was always fun because the guy's like, what did he say?
I had friends at school that used to phone up back when it was a house phone, no mobiles. And if my dad answered the phone, they just hang up. They had no idea what we were saying. but we used to get, apparently when we were quite young, we'd go up to Huntley or Scotland to see the family. And when we came back, we had some weird, and I think mum said some weird Doric Brummy kind of horrible accent.
Well, it was Doric, because I remember mum saying that when we went to nursery and started talking, that the carers, teachers at nursery wouldn't understand us because we had such a thick sort of Doric accent.
To get extra lessons to try and sort ourselves out.
Elocution lessons.
Probably is that why now I get from Greg is how posh I sound.
Well, he ate a sandwich with a knife and fork, so he's got absolutely no room.
Like
a Cody would be absolutely ashamed of that.
Shocking.
But guys, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Apologies, it's just me and not the Badger number one.
He would
have loved to have spoke to you, but we only have three mics, so someone has to leave the room.
Yeah.
And excellent. Thank you very much for that. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. No, really good.
Bye bye. Thank you.